Jimmy Akin is here. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, podcaster extraordinaire over at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, among other places, right?
Yeah.
That's not your only podcast.
No, I'm on multiple podcasts. Yeah. I'm on Catholic Answers Live. I'm on Catholic Answers Today.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
on
Catholic Focus.
Secrets of Star Trek, Secrets of Doctor Who, and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Secrets of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten that, about that one. You and I are both kind of Trekkies.
Mm-hmm.
Not,
yeah.
No, I never had the Star Wars thing hit me like, mm-hmm. but like some people, like it's their thing. So I guess on the fourth day of May, you have to declare.
May the fourth be with you.
Yeah, you have to say whether you're, or at least last year, somebody was asking me, "Well, are you Star Trek or a Star Wars person?" So I said, "Which is more likely to make you my friend?" Mm-hmm. And it didn't work out. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. For a long time, you have been a blogger at the National Catholic Register. Do you still do that, or is that
sometimes?
Oh, this is an occasional.
Especially
thing.
When they ask me.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it. Okay, well, so that's Jimmy. This show, open forum. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, you are welcome to ask it, whether you are Catholic or not.
Yeah. But my main blog is JimmyAkin.com.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
JimmyAkin.com and the podcast, the main podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Let's go to Lucy in Richmond,
okay.
Virginia. She's watching on YouTube. Lucy, are you there with us? Oh, no, Lucy is not there.
So just a tip for folks in the audience. You want to, once you get call screened, you want to listen to your phone because there's a delay between what you hear on your radio and when we pick up the phone. And that's so if someone, you know, there are various reasons for that. But there is a delay. And so you want to make sure you listen to your phone rather than to the radio, because if you're listening to the radio, we're going to be going, hello, hello, hello. And
then
let's move on to another caller.
Yeah. And sometimes we hear stuff we shouldn't be hearing at home, too. So I'm going to go back to Lucy, but I'm going to go to Kevin first in Florida. So Lucy can get situated maybe. Kevin in Florida listening on the Catholic Answers app. Your question, Kevin, for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Si. I really love the show.
Thank you.
Do a great job.
Thank you.
All right. So in Matthew 5:22, it's the teaching about anger, but that's not what my question is about.
Uh-huh.
There's a specific footnote in Matthew where it says Gehenna, in short, southwest of Jerusalem, the city of an idolatrous cult during the monarchy in which children were offered in sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, what is the significance of using specifically the term Gehenna, and what about this term is symbolic about our understanding of hell?
Okay, so I'm not sure what edition of the Bible you're reading there, so I'm, you know, I haven't read this footnote myself. But what I can tell you is that Gehenna, the term is, in its original meaning, it refers to a place that is just next to Jerusalem, part of or just off the Kidron Valley. The Kidron Valley is the one that separates the temple from the Mount of Olives. It's on the east side of Jerusalem. And in the Old Testament period, one of the kind of branches of – there are several valleys around here. And one of them became known as the Valley of Hinnom. Hinnom was a guy, and so he had sons. It's also sometimes called the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. And valley in Hebrew is geh, and Hinnom gets adapted to henna, so it be the Valley of Hinnom became known as the as Gehenna. And it was also a site that was used, as the footnote you read indicated, in an idolatrous cult where people would sacrifice children by fire to pagan gods like Moloch and Baal. And there was a specific place in the Valley of Gehenna known as Topheth where this would happen. And you find mentions of Topheth in the Old Testament. Jeremiah, for example, has a prophecy against what goes on at Topheth in the Valley of Hinnom. And so it could be that the association of the Valley of Hinnom with the fire of child sacrifice is what's responsible, or at least part of what's responsible, for the fact that Jesus picked up the term and applied it metaphorically to hell. It could be that. There have been other suggestions as well. Some people would say, okay, by the first century, the Valley of Hinnom was being used as a garbage dump, and there were fires, you know, to keep the to help purify the garbage and stuff. And
yeah,
that's part of what the image is. But that's not as certain as far as I am aware. So there's a bit of speculation. But what we can say is that this metaphor for hell, or way of referring to the place of the damned as Gehenna, is based on this actual valley that was right there by Jerusalem, where we know at least child sacrifice occurred, where children were burned in the flames to pagan deities.
Thank you, Kevin, for that call. It is open forum. Lucy, I'm getting ready to come to you, so get ready, Lucy. We're coming your way. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. You're welcome to ask any question at all about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Questions about the Bible, about the sacraments, about the Pope, any aspect of Catholic faith, they are all welcome. And now we welcome Lucy in Richmond, Virginia. Lucy, your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Yes. My question is, I don't really understand how the angels were able to decide against God.
Mm-hmm.
If they were living in heaven with the grace, you know. So it kind of makes me scared to think that maybe if when we get to heaven, can we also then decide to go against God?
Okay. The answer is that God chose, at least in the case of us and at least in the case of angels, to give us free will that we would exercise during a probationary period, where we have the option to choose either for or against him. In the case of human beings, that probationary period stretches over the course of our entire life. In the case of angels, we don't know as much about it, but a common view is that it was something they exercised in the first moment of their lives. And so God creates the angel, and instantly the angel makes a choice for or against him. But in both cases, once the probationary period is ended, our wills become fixed either on good or on evil. So in the case of the angels who chose for God, their wills became fixed on good. So they're never going to choose anything that's evil. They might be able to choose among different things that are good, but they're never going to choose something that's fundamentally evil, so they'll never choose against God. By converse, the angels who chose against God had their wills fixed on evil, so they will never reverse that and choose in favor of God. That's why demons can't be saved. It's not, as the Catechism says, because there's a limit to God's mercy. It's because they don't want his mercy, and their will is fixed on evil. In the same way, for humans who die in God's friendship, so their probationary period is now ended, if they die in God's friendship, their will be fixed on good, so that they might choose among different goods perhaps, but they're never going to choose evil. And humans who die outside of God's friendship will have their will fixed on evil, so that they never reverse that and choose in favor of God, which is also the reason that lost human beings are lost and won't ultimately be saved. It's because they've made a definitive choice. So in the case of both humans and angels, God has given us free will for purposes of allowing us to make a definitive choice that then becomes permanent. And so we don't need to worry that if we make it to heaven, we're one day going to choose against God and fall into sin again or fall out of heaven. That won't happen.
Thank you very, very much for that question, Lucy. It was delightful to talk with you. I want to remind folks again that it's this weekend, the events in San Antonio, Texas, the Fullness of Truth Conference with Tim Staples, Trent Horn, and Carlo Broussard, all giving talks on the Eucharist. There will be all kinds of time to be informed and inspired, and hundreds of other Catholics there doing the same thing. So if you're in the San Antonio area and you'd like to participate, you still can. It's at Prince of Peace Catholic Church there in San Antonio, and you can get all the information by going to fullnessoftruth.org, fullnessoftruth.org.
Catholic Answers Live. We're waiting for your call.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Have you ever been so grief-stricken and so heartsick that you can't see God? You can't see God in the tragedy. You can't see God in that cross. You can't see God in that sin. Why? You're enveloped in that grief. You're enveloped in fear. And God is out the window. You don't see Him standing right next to you.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Said we'll take any question about the Catholic faith this hour. Now we're going to prove it. Al in Marcellus, New York. If you have a question, we're going to do our very best to give you an answer.
I don't know if his question's about the Catholic faith. It may be about the Jewish faith.
Oh, man. But That was the wrong time to say we're going to prove it then.
I'm broad-minded. I'll take all kinds of questions. You are indeed.
Even aliens asking about the Jewish faith. I'm not saying Al is an alien.
No.
If one called, you'd take that
call. On the internet, no one knows you're an alien.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. That's a safe place for aliens.
Hey, Al.
Your question for Jimmy?
Yeah. Yeah. So my question is, at what point do the children of Israel basically have a concept of the afterlife?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I asked is a few weeks back I had asked about the Sadducees,
mm-hmm.
and you had basically told me, you know, they were annihilationists, so they didn't believe, mm-hmm. basically, that, you know, once they were dead, that was it. And I actually even looked on your site on the digitized encyclopedia,
mm-hmm.
that you guys have on the Catholic Answer site, and it doesn't even seem they believed in angels either.
Sadducees.
So I'm just wondering, does that mirror what actually the people of Israel believed for a long period of time?
No. The Sadducees were always a minority group. They did not reflect the popular sensibilities of other Jewish people. Now, you will hear some people who frankly ought to know better. You will hear some people say, oh, the Jews didn't originally have a concept of the afterlife, and it was only late in the Old Testament period that the resurrection of the dead was revealed to them. And so originally before that, they were basically all like Sadducees. No. This is nonsense. Belief in the afterlife is a human universal in the sense that it appears in every single human culture without exception. There are individual groups within cultures who may reject the afterlife, but every single culture has it. And that's certainly true in the ancient world, and certainly true of the Israelites. One of the ways we know that is because we have their graves. And like other people, they have grave goods. And so we can – this is another human universal, burying stuff with people for use in the afterlife. You know, even if it's just symbolic that, you know, he's not really going to be physically using this in the afterlife.
Right.
But it's still a gesture acknowledging the reality of the afterlife. Also, so look at the cultural context they developed in. Abraham originally came from Mesopotamia. They believed in an afterlife. He came to Canaan. The Canaanites believed in an afterlife. They went to Egypt. The Egyptians most definitely believed in an afterlife and took extensive preparations to get ready for it. And then they came back to Canaan where people believed in an afterlife. When did this disbelief in an afterlife, when would that have come up?
Yeah, right.
But the fact is we have physical evidence from their graves. I even have a book. I didn't write it, but I have a book by a scholar about the Judahite burial practices and what they imply about belief in an afterlife. Also, we have this phrase that crops up in the Old Testament about how so-and-so lived many days and then he was gathered to his people. And that's one of their metaphors for death. It's like you're going to be with your ancestors in the afterlife.
Oh, how beautiful.
Also, we have express commands in the Old Testament not to use mediums, not to use people who conjure up the dead.
Oh, yeah.
And there would be no point in telling people not to use mediums if none of them believed in the afterlife.
Right.
The only reason you want to tell someone don't call up the dead is if they believe the dead could come in response to that call. And so we have abundant evidence of Israelites, like everybody else, believing in an afterlife. It's true. They did learn more about the afterlife as history progressed, and God gave them more revelation. So they did come to understand the resurrection perhaps later than a general belief in the afterlife. But they always recognized there's some kind of afterlife, and the Sadducees were an aberrant group that didn't.
Okay, Al?
Okay, yeah, that's a lot more clear, you know, because I know there's, as you mentioned, there's some groups like Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, that they kind of try to make the case that basically this belief came out of like of the Hellenization of the Jews or some of the Jews. And I think maybe the Sadducees might have believed that with the Pharisees as well.
Well, the Pharisees were definite believers in the afterlife. Jehovah's Witnesses, I mean, they believe in an afterlife too. But there may be some who argue that that originally Jews didn't, but that is not what the evidence indicates archaeologically or biblically.
Thanks, Al, very, very much. Let's go to Matt now in Fargo, North Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Matt, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Love the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. Protestants teach the extraordinary gifts of the apostles ended when they died.
Some Protestants.
The office was only tempered.
Some Protestants teach that.
Or some, yeah. That, you know, the office was only temporary in order to lay the foundation of the church and its new beginnings. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, why they believe that or teach that and kind of contrast it, you know, with the Catholic understanding?
So let me ask you a question because I want to make sure I'm interpreting your question correctly. When you refer to extraordinary gifts of apostles, are you referring to like charismatic gifts, like the ability to heal or ability to speak in tongues or ability to prophesy? Or are you referring to the office of apostle itself and some of its distinctives?
The office of apostle itself. So we don't have any of those qualities of the office of apostle after the last one died.
Okay. Well, it's clear. I mean, it's clear that we do have aspects of the office of apostle after they died, because one of the aspects of their office was the requirement to teach and evangelize and proclaim God's word. And Protestants would say, oh, yeah, God still means for there to be teachers and evangelizers today. So clearly aspects of the apostolic office have survived. But actually, the majority of Protestants would say there are no apostles today. There are a few who would deny that, mm-hmm. but they're by no means in the majority. They're a very small group. But the thing is, Catholics would agree there are no apostles today, not in the sense of the biblical apostles. The bishops are the successors of the apostles as the highest ruling authorities in Christ's church. So they seceded to the role of being the highest people left once the apostles disappeared, and they consequently have teaching authority and governing authority, but they're not apostles. They're successors of the apostles. And so there are differences between the office of apostle and the office of a bishop. In terms of what precisely some of those differences are, there's a diversity of opinion among theologians. Some theologians, for example, would say, well, any one of the apostles could have infallibly defined something. But today only the Pope can do that all on his lonesome.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But that's a theological speculation. That's not church teaching. The church does, though, acknowledge that there is a difference between the office of apostle and the office of bishops and any other churchman. Now, sometimes Catholics will use the term apostle in a kind of adapted sense, like, you know, St. Mary Magdalene will be called the apostle to the apostles.
All right.
Because she was the one who announced the resurrection to them. Or St. Patrick will be called the apostle to the Irish because he evangelized Ireland. But this is an adapted sense of the word apostle. It doesn't refer to the formal office that Peter and Paul and James and John had. In terms of the formal office, that's something that did end, around the end of the first century when the last of the original apostles died. In terms of what the bishops have, it is aspects of the office of apostle. They have guidance of the Holy Spirit that enables them to teach. They have governing authority that comes to them from Jesus Christ, but they're not simply identical to the original apostles.
Matt, thank you very, very much for that. 888-318-7884, the number here. I had never heard of that there was theological speculation. Say Matthew the Apostle, mm-hmm. he would have spoken infallibly.
He would have had
the ability to. You know, Jimmy, I sometimes wish there was a book that would help me distinguish between theological speculations
uh-huh.
and actual teachings of the church. I wish someone would
So you're wondering which teachings have authority.
Yes, I would like to know who teaches with authority.
Why don't you check out my book, Teaching with Authority?
Oh, what an excellent idea, Jimmy. Do you mean Teaching with Authority? How to cut through doctrinal confusion and understand what the church really says?
That's the one.
That's available right now at Catholic Answers, from a Catholic Answers Press. If you have that question, how do I know? And the thing that actually for me, Jimmy, it's not that question. It's this thing. It's finding out that so many things that I thought were church teaching
mm-hmm.
are actually in a different realm.
It's theological opinion.
Yeah, they're opinions or they're kind of maybe a folk tradition or mm-hmm. something like that. But that
I talk about all of that in this book, including the difference between apostle and bishop.
Teaching with Authority. You can get it now at shop.catholic.com. Let's go to Connor in Brownston. I'm going to say Brownston, Michigan, listening on the Catholic Answers app. I hope that I pronounced that correctly, Connor. Your question for Jimmy?
Yeah, hi, guys. My question is, does the church have a position on video games? I enjoy military combat games or zombie games, which mm-hmm. no one's doubting their violence. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if these are, permissible, even possibly sinful, which I don't really hold that. But I was just kind of wondering because there's a lot of mixed views on this.
Yeah, you got things like Pong and Centipede. And
Pong is just evil. okay, so the church does not have a position on video games. So that means we're going to need to apply the principles of Catholic moral theology here as we would in other circumstances. And basically, video games, like other forms of games, are a type of entertainment. And as long as a form of entertainment doesn't lead you personally into sin, it's okay. If you enjoy it and it's not leading you into sin, then you can do it. So the question then becomes, would video games that incorporate violence, whether it's military-style violence or fantasy-style violence with zombies, is that automatically going to lead you into sin? No, it's not going to automatically lead you into sin any more than reading the Bible and imagining the violence that's found in it is going to automatically lead you into sin. Or watching a war movie or a zombie movie or anything. I mean, we are designed – every single form of entertainment has a form of drama in it.
Right.
And drama is something that involves conflict. I can actually think of a few exceptions to this, but a standard narrative form of entertainment, like a movie or a book or a novel or whatever, is going to have conflict in it of one form or another. It may not involve physical violence, but it involves conflict because that's the nature of drama. If there's no conflict in a story, then it's not going to be entertaining. And the reason we find drama compelling and entertaining is because we encounter drama in our real lives. We are going to encounter situations where we need to defend ourselves either verbally or physically or in some way. And the best way to be ready for those situations is to game them out in your head in advance so that you know how to handle yourself when you are in such a situation. And to get us to game these situations out in our head – God has designed it so that we find gaming it out in our heads entertaining.
Yeah.
That motivates us to think through conflict situations, whether it's interpersonal or emotional or physical conflict, whatever kind of conflict it is, we're going to encounter it. And so God has arranged for us to, in a safe way, pre-think how we would deal with such situations. One of the ways of doing that is through reading fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Another way is through watching movies. Another way is through playing video games. And so all of these actually are ways of helping us learn how to deal with potentially different situations. Even if we're never going to actually encounter a zombie, we will encounter scary situations and need to know how to handle ourselves emotionally. And this is a way of helping to get us to do that. So unless you are being led into sin in some way, it's perfectly legitimate to do these things.
Except for Pong.
Except
because
for
you
Pong.
Said Pong is evil.
Yeah, Pong is evil.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back for more Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Why does God sometimes reveal himself privately? How does the Church discern reports of supernatural miracles and apparitions? What are some of the most famous Marian apparitions in history? And what do they teach us? In 20 Answers, Apparitions and Revelations, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, explaining the scriptural and theological basis for private revelation, unpacking the Church's approach to evaluating and promoting miraculous phenomena, and sharing inspiring accounts of approved apparitions and revelations from the distant past to the present age. 20 Answers, Apparitions and Revelations is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Each month, we have an unscripted show.
You can call and ask us anything.
That's tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now let's return to Catholic Answers Live.
I feel like we're going for some kind of world record today. We are just moving through questions.
Great.
So many. And
I love
and
that.
And there's one line open now.
And we got 30 minutes.
And we got 30 minutes, and you can probably still get that last line if you want it. 888-31-TRUTH. Let us go to Mike in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on 94.9 FM. Mike, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. I was wondering if Matthew, Mark, and Luke had already been martyred by the time John wrote his gospel.
We don't know the answer to this question, and we don't know the answer to it for a couple of reasons. One of them is we don't know that they were all martyred. You sometimes hear reports that, like, all of the apostles except for John were martyred, but those reports are an exaggeration of what we actually know. We do know certain apostles were martyred. We know James, son of Zebedee, was martyred. We know Peter was martyred. We know Paul was martyred. After that, it starts to get fuzzy. And there is even a question about whether John was martyred, because there are some traditions that say John was martyred too. So it's unclear. We certainly don't know if they were martyred. We don't know the dates of their martyrdoms. And so that's one reason, the whole martyrdom situation is one reason we don't know the answer to your question, Mike. The other reason is we don't know the exact dates the Gospels were written, and that so we don't know when John wrote his Gospel for sure. A common opinion is that he wrote it either in the AD 90s or shortly after the year 100. Couldn't have written it too much later than that because we have a fragment of John that dates to the mid-second century. So it had to be certainly no later than that. Personally, I think John wrote before AD 70. I think that you can argue convincingly – and this is just my personal opinion – but I think you can argue convincingly that John did have knowledge of Mark's gospel. And so you can – there's a fascinating paper called John for Readers of Mark by the British scholar Richard Baucom. It's in his book, The Gospels for All Christians. And he argues that John's gospel is actually written to interlock with the outline of Mark. So he expects people to already know Mark, and that's why he can occasionally drop truth bombs like this was before John the Baptist was arrested, out of nowhere without ever mentioning the fact that John the Baptist was arrested other than that.
Because he's making a reference to Mark.
Right, exactly. Okay. And I think there is – so I think it's very clear that John knew about Mark and was writing in response to it. I think it's – a reasonable argument can be made that he also knew Luke because there are certain things in Luke that John seems to flesh out. Like if you look at the resurrection narrative in Luke, he mentions that Peter ran to the tomb and looked inside and went home wondering what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he also mentions that Jesus ate fish in the disciples' presence. Well, both of those get followed up on and elaborated in John's resurrection narrative.
Oh, like let me tell you the full story.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Also, you have there are some scholars who will argue that John also wrote knowing Matthew.
Okay.
That's less clear to me.
Okay.
I did a series of blog posts on my on jimmyakin.com a while back where I explored the dates of the Gospels, and I ended up proposing – and again, this is just my opinion – but based on the evidence, I ended up proposing that Mark was written sometime in the AD 50s, maybe around AD 55, that Luke was written around AD 59, that Acts was written around AD 60, and that Matthew and John were both written around AD 65, plus or minus a few years.
Okay.
So if that's the case, if John did write in AD 65, then there is quite a good chance that all three of the other evangelists were still alive at the time.
Mike, thank you very, very much for that question. I got to say I'm a little disappointed in Mike's call.
Why?
I like when
be nice.
No, I kind of like when people tell us a long story about how they got to this question.
No. You mentioned earlier that we're going through questions today. One of the reasons for that is
people are just asking questions.
People are asking their questions instead of the elaborate backstory of how the question came up.
Yeah, Mike,
I love that.
Mike just, I know you do. That's why I was saying that. I was just teasing Mike. I was not at all disappointed in your call because you just got to your question.
That's awesome.
It's always fun.
More
for
power
us.
To that.
Beto's next in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on St. Michael's Radio. Beto, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. When did Jesus in his humanity become self-aware of his divinity? By the way, I'm a huge fan. I've got most of your books, Jimmy, and I just want to be like you someday in terms of apologetics. But it's a question that I've pondered for several years. I've read the scriptures, and there's really not a clear answer to that question, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. I've just pondered it, and I just wanted to...
Well, thank you. You're extremely kind, and I'll give you the best answer I can, but I can't give you a definitive answer because this is not something that because there's a diversity of opinion on this subject. What I can say is that Luke chapter 2 gives us evidence that Jesus – at least if you give it any ordinary reading, Jesus was certainly aware of his divinity by the time he was 12 because he's at the temple and he's aware that God is his father in a privileged sense compared to anybody else, including Saint Joseph. Mm-hmm. And so that would indicate an awareness on Jesus' part that he is the Son of God in a very special sense that's different from the way other people are children of God. And consequently, that's an indication that he's aware of his divinity at that point. In terms of how far back does it proceed? Well, now you mentioned in his humanity. I was going to say, if you just said, when did he know he was divine? Well, he always knew he was divine in his divine intellect.
Yeah.
So in his divinity, he always knew this. The question is, when did he become aware of it in his human intellect, that's based in his human nature? Well, there have been different understandings of that during the course of church history. During much of church history, the common theological opinion was that Jesus's human intellect always included a knowledge of all actualities. So it's not quite omniscience in that he didn't necessarily know all possibilities,
right,
but he knew all actualities.
Okay.
And so that would mean all the way down through his life from the conception onward, he would in his humanity have known that he is also God. More recently, there has been a kind of a resourcement to biblical passages where Jesus does not know all actualities, and he has to ask questions. And the Catechism says that because his human knowledge was legitimately human knowledge, it had to grow over time. And so that would seem to suggest he didn't always have all knowledge of all actualities, mm-hmm. and he could grow in wisdom, as mm-hmm. Luke says.
Right.
So in terms of what he did know, the Catechism says that he knew everything that pertained to his mission,
mm-hmm.
and the fact he's God pertains to his mission, so he would have known that. The Catechism doesn't say he had this knowledge all the way down through from conception onward, though.
Right.
And it would be difficult to see how an embryo, a zygote, that is just a single cell and doesn't even have neurons, would have a human intellect at that point.
Right.
So you'd okay. either have to propose that God supernaturally infused this knowledge into Jesus's latent human intellect so that it was there and you have a conscious zygote mm-hmm. at the one cell stage miraculously.
Right.
Or you could say, well, this infused knowledge was there, but it was latent until his neurology developed to the point that he could express this knowledge. So he would perhaps have an early intuition of his divinity, but then, you know, he learns the word God at, say, age 14 months and says, that's what I am.
Yeah.
And as soon as he learns the meaning of the word God in Aramaic.
So he has to get insight into his experience like everyone else does.
Right.
But it's just his experience is much more vast than ours.
Right. And his knowledge is more vast. But you have a difference of opinion among theologians. The classic position would say he knew it all from the zygote stage onward.
Mm-hmm.
The more recent position is that his human knowledge was more limited. In his book on the infancy narratives, Benedict XVI says that Jesus did not live in a kind of practical omniscience, that he really did have to learn stuff.
Right.
But I would assume, my personal opinion would be that this knowledge was infused at conception. And then it most likely became manifest later as Jesus developed the brain cells needed to have an active human intellect, and as he learned, this is the meaning of the word Allah in Aramaic.
Yes, fair enough. Okay, Beto, this is such a fascinating question.
It's all speculation.
Is that okay with you, Beto? Does that make sense? So, where are you?
I agree with Jimmy's position in terms of I think that Jesus in his the hypostatic union, he would have to have some type of concept of his divinity infused at the moment of conception. But I also think that it would have to be developed just like an infant has developed how to walk, how to talk. I think he developed on who he was as he learned himself, just like we would discern our vocation in life. I think Jesus had that same ability, maybe, you know, at 2 years old, 3 years old, I don't know. But I've always wondered the question.
I would be inclined, and as I indicate, this is speculation, so this isn't a hard and fast position. I submit to the judgment of the church on all this.
Mm-hmm.
But I would speculate that Jesus had the concept before he had the words to express it. Mental ease is not the same thing as our native language, and we can frequently see things in mentalese before we can translate them into – before we can verbalize them.
Like you know your mother before you ever know the word mother.
Exactly.
Long before you ever know the word mother. Okay. Beto, thank you very, very much. Very interesting. Hey, we talked about Jimmy's book, Teaching with Authority. And all, that book and all the other Catholic Answers publications continue on sale at shop.catholic.com. Save 15% off store-wide when you put in the promo code SPRING19 at checkout at shop.catholic.com.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Radio gives us an opportunity to become part of a larger family. It can be so lonely when we are struggling in our faith or just try to live our faith on our own. But Catholic Radio connects us to that larger community of faith where we're able to get the support, the encouragement, and the grace that we need to not just struggle on, but to really celebrate all the blessings that God brings into our life through our Catholic faith.
Dr. Greg Popcheck thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Josh in Illinois, you are next. Josh, your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I had a friend who was a Protestant, was killed in an accident. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of trying to minister to some friends of ours who are not Catholic, as she was not, and I'm trying to find a way to explain to them that just because she wasn't Catholic, that the church believes there's a possibility for her salvation, and this person lived what I can only describe as a holy life, to the best that we know.
So you want help explaining the church's... Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Well, if you're wanting to show this to non-Catholic friends, one way to do it would be just to show them what the church's teaching is on this. And you can find that – I mean you can find that in the Second Vatican Council's document Lumen Gentium, which is available online. But it's also excerpted in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And so it's like around paragraph 846 or something like that in the Catechism. And so you can look at what it says there. And, you know, show it to your friends or quote it for them. But basically, the church says that while there is an obligation to join Jesus' church, assuming you know it's his church and that that he wants you to be part of it, well, there is an obligation to do that. But this and if you knowingly and deliberately refuse to do that, it can jeopardize your salvation. But this assertion is not directed against people who are innocently unaware of the fact that the Catholic Church is his church. And so it is possible for God to share his grace with them and for them to be saved as well. And so the church understands that there will be a lot of people in heaven who weren't Catholic in this life, but who were sincerely responding to God's grace and trying to do what he wanted as they understood it. And so such people can indeed be saved. And the fact that your friend showed evidence in her life of cooperating with God's grace by leading a holy life, that provides reasons for confidence and reasons for hope in her salvation.
Thank you, Josh. Let us go now to Julie in Colorado, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 130. Julie, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. I love your show. The reason I was calling was that
my understanding is that they crucified people by driving nails through their wrist because it wouldn't have, their hands would have never held them up. And so if that's the case, then why does Thomas and lots of other folks in the Bible refer to seeing the nail marks of his hands? And why do we, most of our crucifixes show nails in his hands if they really nailed them through the wrist?
There are a couple of areas here that we need to talk about. The first one is, did people only get crucified through their wrists? Because that's kind of the basis of this claim, that people only got crucified through the wrist because the flesh in your hand couldn't support the weight of the body or as much of the weight of the body as would be put on it. Turns out that claim is false. People sometimes may have been crucified through their wrists. My understanding, though, is actually people would be given like pedestals to stand on, and so or their ankles would be nailed, and so they're not having to support all of the weight of their body just through the flesh of their hands.
Okay.
Also, sometimes people were tied.
Yeah.
So there were other ways. I would want to recheck this, but I think actually even without that, it may be possible to nail someone through the palm. But there were other ways to take the load off of the palms, either by tying someone or giving them a pedestal to stand on or nailing their ankles.
Yeah.
It's not at all certain that Jesus had to be crucified through the wrists. In the other area we need to talk about is the meaning of the term hand in Greek or hands in Greek. It does primarily refer to your palm and your fingers or the back of your hand and your fingers, what we would think of as the hand. But it also had flexibility to where it could include the wrists.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, even if Jesus was crucified through the wrist, you could still have him saying things like, "See my hands," where the word hand is understood as including the wrists.
Yeah.
And so because the primary meaning of the word is hand, though, that's why we see Jesus depicted in Christian art typically as being crucified through the palms, which are clearly part of the hand, as opposed to the wrist, which is not as clearly a part of the hand.
Julie, thank you very much. Let us go now to Karen in Geneseo, Kansas, listening on Divine Mercy Radio. Karen, your question.
Hi. This kind of goes back to what Lucy's question and Jimmy's answer.
Okay.
I just want to know, for humans then, where does purgatory fit if their probationary period ends at death and they make a decision or whatever?
Okay.
How does that fit with purgatory?
So purgatory is the final purification, or you might even say the final sanctification, the final part of the process of sanctification that God uses to prepare us for heaven. And so at the moment of death, you've made your basic decision for or against God, but you may still need to be purified. You may have some residual consequences of sin, some lingering, you know, like woundedness in your nature. Even though you've made the decision for God, you may need some spiritual healing to occur at that point. You may have some spiritual debt that needs to be dealt with. And so that's what purgatory is for. It is not another chance to make a decision. Your decision has already been made, and now the consequences of that decision are being implemented for you. So it's like saying, yes, I want to check into the hospital and be cured of my disease. Okay, now you're checked in. Now the process of curing your disease continues.
Karen, I'm going to keep moving because I want to get everybody in. Thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Mike in Buffalo, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Mike, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. So I was born Catholic, raised in the faith through school. And
okay. What's your question? Because we're getting close to the end of the show.
Let's shoot to it. So my question is the Catholic idea of predestination, as referred to in the first book of Ephesians, and how that works with our free will.
So I don't know that I can provide an adequate treatment of that in the moments we have left on the show, because there's not a single Catholic view of predestination. Sometimes people will talk about the Catholic view of predestination as if there was only one, and there's not. There are multiple possible understandings of predestination. And I also can't really go through and do an exegesis of Ephesians 1 and all of the different aspects it has to say on that subject. So what I would suggest is taking a look at a book called Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma, and it's by a guy named Ludwig Ott, and he has a section on some of the different understandings of predestination that have been proposed in the course of Catholic history. His book, though, was written in the 1950s, and so it doesn't include some of the more recent ideas that have been proposed about predestination. The Catechism has a very brief discussion of predestination in which it talks about the fact that in predestining events, God takes into account what he foresees the choices of our free will be. So he can foresee from his eternal perspective how we use our free will and then incorporate that into his plans and thus incorporate it into his predestination of various things. So that's kind of a brief sketch. If you want to call back on another show and have a more specific question about Ephesians 1, like how does it square with this particular statement in Ephesians 1, I'll be happy to try to help you out some more.
Thanks, Mike. Let's go to Daniel in New York, listening on KEXS. Daniel, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, my question was pretty much about the discernment between apostles and disciples, and specifically about Paul, because sometimes I hear him being considered as an apostle, even though he wasn't one of the original 12. And even then you had Matthias who replaced Judas. So.
Right. So let me answer this one, because we're close to the end of the show. The term apostle or apostolos in Greek or sliha in Aramaic, it means someone who is sent, someone who is a delegate, like an ambassador. A disciple just means a student. And so the Greek word for disciple, it just means someone who studies under somebody else. So everyone who is a follower of Jesus studies the teaching of Jesus. Everybody is a disciple. But then some of the disciples, some of Jesus's students, have been commissioned as his ambassadors to go do stuff on his behalf. And that originally included the 12. So they get called apostles in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Interestingly, John never uses the word. He just refers to the disciples. Paul and Barnabas, though, were also apostles. They were also sent to conduct business on behalf of Jesus. Paul links that, for example, to his own conversion experience, where even though he wasn't one of the original 12, he was commissioned by Jesus to go preach the gospel. And he and Barnabas both were commissioned to preach the gospel by the Holy Spirit in Acts chapter 13. So you can read about that as well. So that we want to distinguish between the 12 that were a special group that were meant to be eyewitnesses of the ministry of Jesus, which is why Judas was replaced, and other apostles that were not members of the 12, like Paul and Barnabas. And then further beyond that, everyone who's a follower of Jesus studies his teachings and thus is his student or disciple.
Okay, Daniel.
Thank you. So there were a total of 14 then.
At least. There are other indications. There are some passages that could be taken to indicate that Silvanus or Silas was also an apostle. James the Just, the so-called brother of the Lord, is referred to in one passage that some have taken to indicate he was an apostle. Timothy is sometimes also proposed. So there are other individuals. The term apostle was a looser one, and we don't necessarily need to think of there as being a specific number or a total number that we can discern at this date in history.
Jimmy, if I could, during the course of Jesus' ministry, from what we have in Scripture, the 12, however, do stand out.
Yes.
Like he treats them differently than—
They had a special role, and they were meant to be eyewitnesses of his ministry, which is why when Judas has died, Peter says, we need to pick someone who's been with us from the baptism through the end of Jesus' ministry.
Right.
Interestingly, Matthew didn't meet that qualification, but Jesus named him one of the 12 anyway.
He's the boss.
Yeah.
He can do what he wants. Again, Jimmy's most recent book, Teaching with Authority, How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says, is out now and available. You can get it at shop.catholic.com, where you can get everything 15% off right now by putting in the promo code SPRING19. Jimmy Akin, thank you for another very fine hour.
My pleasure.
I say it with no sense of finality because I believe I will be seeing you again tomorrow.
Ooh, maybe we'll play a game.
Yes, I think we will. I hope so.
Good thing we talked about games today and set the stage for that.
Yeah, and we established that Pong is evil. That's very important that we
So we won't play Pong.
But we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.